This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week, Dolan Perkins Valdez tells us about her historical novel, Happy Land, based on the true story of a post-Civil War black community that dared to dream of sovereignty, and what was lost when that dream was stolen. Then Nancy Reddy joins us to talk about The Good Mother Myth, a revelatory exploration of how flawed ideas about motherhood, shaped by patriarchy, capitalism, and bad science, still haunt us today. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. We last spoke with Dolan Perkins Valdez about her historical novel, Take My Hand, which unearthed a disturbing real-life episode of reproductive injustice in 1970s Alabama. Now, in her new novel, Happy Land, Perkins Valdez tells a tale based on the remarkable true story behind a kingdom founded after the Civil War by formerly enslaved people. Straddling the border of North and South Carolina, Happy Land was a place where a black queen ruled and the community thrived on self-sufficiency, enterprise, and shared governance. An intentional kingdom that successfully embodied black sovereignty, it was eventually undermined by institutionalized land theft. Let's listen as Dolan Perkins Valdez talks about the themes of legacy, deep ties to the land, and what it costs when history is erased. Dolan Perkins Valdez, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
I totally enjoyed this novel, your third novel. We've spoken to you before about your second, Take My Hand. Happy Land is based on a true place, one of several communities that were established by African Americans after slavery. We spoke earlier this year with Aaron Robertson about the community that his family was part of, Promised Land. This is Happy Land. First, tell us about the real place, how you found out about it, and decided to write a novel based on it.
Well, it's great to open with Aaron Robertson's work because Promised Land had a lot more people than Happy Land did. But the thing that was so unique about the Happy Land that caught my attention was that they imagined themselves as royalty and they named a king and a queen. It was sort of the next step of imagining an intentional community, a nation within a nation. And I thought that was very unique, which is why I ultimately decided to write about it. But I began to investigate after stumbling on it during the pandemic. My pandemic hobby was learning to play the banjo. And I was researching Western North Carolina old-time musicians when I stumbled on this story in a Hendersonville newspaper. And I was just intrigued by it. I wanted to know how much of it was true and how much of it was local lore.
So what did you derive from that? What inspired you so much about it?
Well, I knew that after I spoke with a couple of locals, I knew that more research needed to be done to find out what happened on that mountain. So I was inspired by just working with two locals, Ronnie Pepper and Suzanne Hale, who were so helpful and who were such great partners in this research endeavor that I just wanted to do my part, which was to write the book that I promised them I would write using a lot of the research that we unearthed.
And the story has two parallel tracks, one that takes place after the Civil War with the establishment of Happy Land, and the other takes place in current times. Just tell us briefly, introduce us to these two interweaving storylines.
Well, the reason I wrote the contemporary storyline is because I wanted to know, what did it cost us not to know our history? Or what does it cost us not to know our history? In the book, Nikki, the contemporary character, knows nothing about this. And she's really in a state of disbelief when her grandmother first mentions it to her. So I knew that in order to explore that question, I needed a contemporary storyline. You know, my approach to historical fiction is that, you know, you unearth this history, you think it's fascinating, but that's not enough. I have to ask myself as a writer, what am I bringing to the story? What is the perspective that I bring to the page? I'm not just a historian. I'm also a storyteller. So I lend a perspective. I ask questions. And my question here had to do with, what did it cost us? What did it mean to lose our family land? And then what did it cost us in terms of the bonds of family and community? And even just what Nikki might imagine for herself. I think she never even had the ability or the inspiration to imagine greater things for herself, precisely because she didn't know her history.
Yes, and in fact, much is made of the fact that nobody has gone to college in her family, and then she finds out actually that somebody did, and that inspires her daughter to carry on. So, you know, just that whole sense of how our past informs our own sense of who we are is so important. And before we kind of take up that whole issue of the loss of land, let's talk about the gaining of the land. Talk about the circumstances that face the characters in this novel, typical circumstances that face them, I guess, as the backlash to Reconstruction happened, and especially in North and South Carolina at this time.
Yes, often we hear about after emancipation, a lot of people end up, a lot of Black people, a lot of freed people end up in a sharecropping system, in a kind of another type of bondage. We often hear about that and read about that, but we don't often read about the aspirations of those freed people to own their own piece of land. And a lot of them did manage to buy a piece of land. Some pieces were large, some parcels were larger than others. In the book, these folks come up from South Carolina and they eventually managed to buy over 200 acres of land that spans the North Carolina and South Carolina border. Half of that land was in the name of a woman by the name of Luella Bobo, and the other in the name of a man, Robert Montgomery. So not only are we talking about Black folks owning land, we're also talking about a Black woman being a deed holder, which is just remarkable to me. It must have meant so much to them when we think about land ownership as a type of declaration of citizenship. In the American experiment, that was how the American experiment established it, right? That land ownership established you as a citizen. It established your right to vote. It established your right to be completely enfranchised. And they desired that. And they got it.
They did, at least for a while. Tell us about your character, Luella, how you portray her. You know, as you mentioned, this was incredibly unusual for the historic Luella to be a landowner. In this book, she's also the queen, and not just the queen to a king, but she becomes really the ruler of her community, although it's not really a hierarchical monarchy. So talk about Happy Land, how it's set up, what it is based on, and tell us about Luella.
What's interesting, you know, when I'm working on a book, I kind of forget the real history because I have to really enter the realm of the imagination. And so in my mind, everything starts to blur. I'm not quite sure what's real and not real. And when my friend Suzanne, who's a Hendersonville resident and who helped me with a lot of this research, when she read the manuscript recently, she said, there's a lot of the real history in there. And she reminded me of so much that's true. So it's true that Luella Bobo was named the queen. That's her real name. It's true that she was the deed holder. It's true that she established a school there in the kingdom for children. It's true that they developed a product called the Happy Land Liniment that was hugely successful in that area. It's true that at one point she is married to William Montgomery. He's the king and she's the queen. And later on, William leaves and Robert, his brother, becomes king and she's still the queen. So I took those different aspects that we found in the archival research and I created a narrative for her, because my question I had was, what did women desire during this time? I wanted to capture a little bit of that, because I believe Luella Bobo must have been a remarkable woman, and the women in that community must have been remarkable. And so I wanted to have a little bit of their voices incorporated here. And was there another part of that question you asked that I'm not answering?
Oh, just what's Luella like?
Yeah, I think she's ambitious. She cares a lot about the community. She wants to love and be loved. I imagined that one of the things that a woman might have gained in the era of freedom was the right to choose a partner who they actually loved, rather than based on more practical reasons, or to not choose a partner at all, like her best friend Jola, who never marries. And so I thought Luella is a woman who follows her heart, and she's also incredibly smart. She knows how to manage the people around her. And oh, you mentioned about the monarchy. It isn't a hierarchical monarchy. I imagined, based on what I read, that it was more of what we might think of in contemporary times as a constitutional monarchy. In my book, they have a council that helps to make the decisions for the kingdom. And the reason I think that is because everything in the archive pointed to their sense of community. They pool together their earnings and their resources. I even read that the houses were, this doesn't necessarily come up in the book, but I read somewhere that the houses were arranged in a circle, which to me suggests that there was a type of, even though we have them in the history books as a monarchy, there must have also been a kind of shared power, a kind of egalitarianism that they participated in and that made them want to be there and to put their money in that treasury.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guest is novelist Dolan Perkins Valdez, and she's telling us about her new novel, Happy Land. It's based on the true story of a post-Civil War Black kingdom in the Carolinas. So they buy 200 acres that are on either side of the border between North and South Carolina. But ultimately, and I don't want to give anything away, ultimately they lose a lot of that land. And the story really does center around how that land was lost. Heirs, property, this was a word, a phrase that I'd never heard before. But you explore how this heirs property law ended up basically disappropriating huge numbers of African Americans from their land and is a major contributor to the racial wealth gap.
It is. I was talking to a legal theorist and professor, Professor Derek Hamilton. And as he was explaining heirs property to me, I felt so outraged, Francesca. I said, how could they do that? And he said, you have to remember, Dolan, that it was legal to do so. And so the way heirs property worked, and I'll just be pretty brief in my description about it, but someone would die without a will, and their heirs would inherit it. It would be heirs who were considered tenants in common, and then the next generation, and then the next generation. And at some point, you might have many, many people who were heirs, tenants in common. And someone could come along and ask one of those heirs to sell their share. They would sell it, maybe not knowing what that might trigger. And then the person could force a partition sale or could force the sale of the property. The problem was that other shareholders were not notified. They would put it in a little newspaper, but it was not anything that they might have read. And then they could force a sale of the property on the courthouse steps without the family even knowing. And so when I say that property was sold right out from under people's feet, I mean that literally, like people were still living there and their property would be sold with this loophole in the law. And that happened to many, many families. There were other ways that Black folks lost their land. Some, you know, just more nefarious. Someone just could run you off or take your deed or trick you. But heirs property was a way that contributed greatly to the loss over the 20th century. And it's quite sad, really, because we still only have 24 states that have passed legislation started by or written and and underscored by Thomas Mitchell, a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and legal professor. We only have 24 states that have passed this act, which helps to make sure that people are given due process before their land is sold. But North Carolina has not passed the act.
North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, was kind of a real center of the Ku Klux Klan. Is that right? Or was it South Carolina?
It was really South Carolina in this context. They had the KKK trials in 1871 and 1872. Part of it was that there were so many freed people in South Carolina. All throughout the history of slavery, South Carolina had a particularly high number of enslaved people who lived there. And so after emancipation, they began to elect, Black men got the right to vote, and they began to elect statewide Black elected officials. And the KKK rose up and was really trying to stamp out Black political power and Black economic power. They were particularly vicious in South Carolina. And we believe that's why the original kingdom founders fled South Carolina in such a hurry.
Now, they are really a picture of resourcefulness and resilience. And you write, I think it's in the afterword, that the history of African-American industriousness is often overshadowed by what followed. Unpack that for us. What do you mean by the history of African-American industriousness and what overshadowed it?
Well, I think I'm talking about, I don't have the book in front of me, but I think I'm talking about the 1890s, which are often characterized by historians as the nadir of African-American experience. This is the rise of lynching at its highest point. And it is when African-Americans become, after Reconstruction ends in 1875-76, and federal troops are pulled out of the South, the oppression of Black folks in the South begins in great severity. So we often think about sort of the era of lynching and the era of sharecropping and all of those kinds of things in the late 1800s, rather than thinking about Black striving. And that had to do with the desire to own property. That had to do with the Black women's club movement as Black women organized. It was not coincidental that Du Bois and others would head up to upstate New York to create the Niagara movement in the early 1900s. That kind of intellectual and resistant activity had been brewing all along. And so one of the things I really wanted to reveal in this book is just another aspect of that era.
I love something that you say also in the afterword. You say that in your imagining of this kingdom, that it's both a literal and metaphorical manifestation of people's desire to rise into their full humanity. And then you go on to talk about how this full humanity is connected to their relationship to the land. What did make land so critical for African Americans after the Civil War, and when so many had to leave the South and move to the cities in the Great Migration? What happened to that sense of land?
So when we think about the land, we can think of it in a few different ways. We can think about the land as a vehicle through which one can build wealth. It's also a way, like I said, a way in which one could become a sort of fully enfranchised American citizen, right? The history of property ownership is connected to voting in this country. So if you were a white male property owner, you could vote, those kinds of laws. And so we could think of the land in that way, but we can also think of the land, and this is one of the reasons I have my main character is a bird watcher and her grandmother has a garden and we have this beautiful cover image with a woman with flowers in her hair. Another way to think of the land is it's our connection to the natural world. And it's rooted in community, right? Like when we own land, we had a place where we could gather and we had a place where we could sort of fellowship as family members and as community members. We had a place where we could grow our own food and be self-sustaining, where we could have a couple of, you know, hogs out there and some chickens that laid eggs, right? There were ways in which Black folks could really be self-reliant when they owned land. You mentioned the Great Migration. I think that's really important. As Black folks left the South and moved north for these industrial jobs, because violent racial intimidation was so severe in the South, that was a huge reason people left, but also because they were just poor and there was a promise of economic opportunity up north, we lost that connection to the land. And so part of what I'm asking when I say that this land is a metaphorical representation, what I'm saying is I had to ask myself, well, what did we lose other than wealth? I mean, wealth is big and wealth is connected to this, but what else did we lose? We lost our connection to the natural world. We lost our connection to community. One of the reasons Ayers property law was so successful is because some of those folks didn't even know the other people that owned a share in the land. They had become disconnected from each other, from their cousins. And so I'm hopeful that one of the things that the book does for all of us who read it is to encourage us to go outside, to take up amateur bird watching, to plant some flowers in our yard. And if we don't have a yard, in a container, you know, to help us to regain in this era of screens and individual isolation, to regain a sense of community and friendship and family.
This is a wonderful historical novel. We spoke in the beginning how important it is for people to remember their history in order to know where they're going and who they are. And we are living now in a time when the forces of white supremacy have taken over the highest, you know, the highest offices in the land, the highest places in our government, and are actively trying to erase African-American history in every single way that they can. Authors like yourself have seen their books banned in libraries. I wonder if you could comment on what that feels like and how that informs how you see your work.
Well, you know, I'll just say it's devastating. It's devastating because I don't understand how, and you know, I'm a native Southerner, Francesca. I'm from Memphis, born and raised. And I just don't understand how you study American history without African-American history being a part of that. The narratives are too intertwined. We are, for better or for worse, right? We are neighbors. And in some cases, we are family. We are community members. We're in this together. So the very idea of extricating a part of that and erasing it, banning books and changing curricular guidelines, et cetera, is unfathomable to me and devastating. And what I can say is that this is a moment that calls on us as individuals. And I know this because I live in Washington, D.C., and often I feel really powerless because I'm not a legislator and I'm not a lobbyist and I never go to Capitol Hill. I don't even know anybody who's powerful in this town, really. I'm just a little old writer and professor. But I do think there is something powerful in people-led movements. There's something really powerful in that. And we have a way of communicating because we've got social media. This is a moment for us to rise up as individuals, for us to intentionally choose the books that we read in defiance of this current narrative that's trying to ban books and suppress narratives. This is a time for us to support our librarians and teachers who are doing the best they can already with very little funding, but who are at risk of losing funding. This is a time for us to donate to the Friends of the Library, a time for us to donate to our local teachers and support them. This is just a time for us to just do whatever little act we can to make sure that our children and grandchildren learn everything and grow up in a world that's loving and tolerant and honest.
And your book is such a wonderful way, a companion on that road. The book is Happy Land and Dolan Perkins Valdez. It's just been so great to talk with you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for the invitation.
Dolan Perkins Valdez is the New York Times best-selling author of several novels and teaches literature at American University in Washington, D.C. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our previous conversation with her about her novel, Take My Hand. Next up, The Myth of the Good Mother. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. The birth of a new baby is a magical time of wondrous love and maternal bliss, the fulfillment of a woman's natural purpose. At least that's what legions of mostly male psychologists and pediatricians have told women for ages. But the reality is just a little more nuanced than that. Because becoming a mother is also often accompanied by sleepless nights, anguished second-guessing, and mourning the loss of personal freedom. Feelings that many new mothers, including yours truly back in the day, thoroughly blame on themselves. In her book, The Good Mother Myth, Unlearning Our Bad Ideas About How to Be a Good Mom, writer, scholar, and poet Nancy Reddy discusses the myths surrounding ideal motherhood, how they evolved, why they persist, and whom they leave out. Reddy critiques attachment theory, the capitalist agenda behind parenting advice, and the absence of real community in caregiving. Reddy also shares insights from her personal journey as a new mother and calls for a redefinition of love and care for children that includes not only fathers, but the wider community. I spoke with Reddy recently. Let's hear that conversation now. Nancy Reddy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I was so happy to read your book.
Thank you.
I am a grandmother, so clearly I was a parent at one time. And this book, I just have to say, I wish it had been available back when I became a new mother. You begin the book with, "Before I had a baby, I was good at things." And then a few pages later, you say, "This is a story about how you stopped being good." Talk first about some of the struggles you experienced when you had your first baby.
I mean, to me, at the center of it really was the idea that motherhood was something that you could study and prepare for and plan for and do well. It was something that you could master, you know, in the same way that I and, you know, lots of other women had mastered other things in my life, you know, various professional accomplishments and those kinds of things. And so, you know, I applied that kind of discipline to, you know, my pregnancy, to my preparation for childbirth, like reading all the books about how I was supposed to take care of my baby after he was born. And then, spoiler alert, like babies don't actually work that way. And then suddenly I had this tiny person living in the house with me. And, you know, now he's almost 12 and he's wonderful. And he was always wonderful, but he was a tough baby. And it was a really hard time for me because I really had to learn that being a mother was very different than I had anticipated. And also that there was something kind of fundamentally wrong with the approach that I had taken, this kind of professionalization and the studying and the practice and all of that, that actually is a pretty stressful and kind of joyless way to approach the whole thing anyway.
You also say that this is the story, the good mother myth is the story of our bad ideas about motherhood. I found this very interesting because you really situate the ideas, the bad ideas of mothering very squarely within our social and economic structure. In fact, you say that the good mother isn't really a person, that she is a subject of capitalism. So connect the dots for us there.
So the good mother, as I talk about her in the book, and I think, you know, as I've done lots of events and talked to lots of people about the book, I think it's a kind of archetype that resonates, is someone who is able to just do everything, who is powered by this incredible selfless love and is able to do everything to take care of her baby, who just instinctively knows what she needs to do and, you know, for whom no sacrifice is too much. And A, that's not really how being a person works at all. You know, I discovered pretty quickly that I was still a person of my own who still had my own needs in addition to trying to meet my baby's needs. But it's also not really, I don't think, what babies or mothers or families need, that this kind of construction that we have of what it means to be a good mother is so much more about getting women to do the kind of tremendous unpaid labor of producing more future workers and taxpayers than it is about like what actually makes for thriving families and healthy communities.
And you do a lot of reporting about the theories of parenting that, of course, have been so destructive to mothers and probably to babies over the years. They're largely theories that are devised by men, or in some cases, the women that were connected to these men. Talk about attachment theory. This was something I studied when I was getting a master's in counseling psychology, but I was very surprised the other day when my 21-year-old granddaughter brought up the word attachment theory. So I realized that this is, you know, first of all, it was something that I accepted as completely a given when I was taught it. And so is she. I mean, how many, like 30 years later? So tell us about attachment theory.
I'm really fascinated by how very niche psychological studies and theories can make their way out into the world. And attachment theory is certainly one. You know, it was developed by John Bowlby and later by Mary Ainsworth, as you alluded to, in the, you know, immediate kind of post-war period, post-World War II. And you know, they really initially were trying to answer this question of, you know, what does a baby need from its mother? What does a baby need in order to grow into someone who's, you know, healthy and capable and, again, able to become a good worker? And it's fascinating to me that this initially small collection of studies has just come into our shared consciousness as just common sense about what a baby needs. And at the center of that for me really is the idea that, and John Bowlby is very explicit about this, as Mary Ainsworth was, that what a baby needs is the undivided attention, the total love and total adoration of a single primary caregiver. Bowlby talks about the mother, by which he means very clearly the biological mother of the child. Later, people will say, oh, you know, it could be any sort of caregiver. It could be the father. But I think it's pretty clear that it's women who are meant to be doing this work. And I don't know, that assumption that a baby needs one person to be at the center of their world has really become, for me, it's something that's kind of so deeply ingrained that it's very hard to even kind of recognize it as an idea and not just a universal truth about the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it put me in mind of when my son was just born, and of course, I was nursing him, and he was very much like your son in some ways. I mean, he cried a lot. He was only quiet in the car or in the stroller outside because he had some real struggles in the first few months, and he was nursing just about every hour and a half, and then it took about an hour to nurse him.
Oh.
And I remember, you know, reading while he was nursing. You know, I'm a reader. I really missed reading.
Mm-hmm.
And his father got very angry at me, you know, that I was dividing my attention. I was supposed to just gaze into his eyes the entire time that he was nursing. And I felt so guilty about it.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's kind of funny now, but I imagine it was not funny at the time. But I think that's exactly the way that attachment theory has come into our culture, right? That it's not enough that you are nursing this baby basically around the clock, right? If you're nursing for an hour and then it takes another hour and a half to get him down, like, you're not sleeping. And that is, you know, disastrous for a lot of people's mental health. Certainly it was for mine. And the idea that not only are you supposed to be doing this bodily work, but you also have to be totally emotionally engaged as well. You know, that you have to be, you know, gazing at your baby. I think sometimes about the kind of tyranny of people saying to new mothers, like, oh, enjoy every moment. I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, I tried, but some parts of taking care of a new baby are not enjoyable. And I think if we're a little more honest about that, it's probably better for everyone.
And yet, you know, interestingly enough, one of the first people you talk about is Harry Harlow with his experiments around mothers who really couldn't pay attention at all because they were monkey mothers, quote unquote, that were wireframes covered in cloth. Talk about these experiments and what they, first of all, what they purported to say, and then whether they actually meant anything at all.
Sure. And I'm really fascinated by Harlow. I started with him in part because he was a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which is where also I went to graduate school and where we lived when my children were born. And so I felt this real kind of, you know, place connection to him and to these studies that he had done that became really central to attachment theory. And so he was trying to learn basically how do you raise a healthy monkey in laboratory conditions. It initially started as a kind of like, how can you raise a colony of monkeys? Because of course it's cheaper to do that than it is to have to be constantly shipping them from, you know, elsewhere when they get sick. So he designed this study where a newborn rhesus macaque monkey, they're these very small monkeys, would be separated from its mother and raised in an experimental condition. As you say, there were these mother surrogates, and they would be either a wire mother, which is just kind of a wire cone with a bottle in it, or a cloth mother, which is that same wire, but wrapped with terry cloth and warmed. And the thing that he found that really shocked him, and I do think it was important at the time, you know, it was the mid to late 50s when he's doing and publishing this research, was that it wasn't the food that mattered, that no matter which of these surrogate mothers fed the babies would cling to the cloth mother. They would spend, the lab techs had to watch it, and they would spend like 18, 20 hours a day just clinging to these soft, warm mothers. So Harlow puts out this really beautiful, actually, paper. He gave this as a talk at the American Psychological Association the year that he was president. And he calls it the nature of love. I mean, he really believed that he had discovered the origins of love and the idea that what you need, that what babies need is not just food, but contact, comfort. And it really was an important finding at the time. You know, it was an era when, you know, if children went into the hospital, oftentimes their children weren't allowed to visit them. You know, if children were being raised in orphanages, they were raised in pretty, what we would see now as inhumane conditions, you know, without really any kind of comfort. So, you know, it's a really important finding at the time, but it ends up having this kind of long lifespan where a lot of the nuance of his research actually gets lost.
And before we actually get to that nuance, one of the things that's so interesting about it is that he actually said at one point that anybody can be a mother, because after all, this was a wire structure covered by cloth. If that can be a mother, anybody can. And yet nobody picked up on the implications of that.
I know. Isn't that, it's such a beautiful finding. And it's this like throw away a couple of sentences, or maybe just sentences that don't get picked up on towards the end of this talk, where he says, basically, you know, if it's not nursing, then anyone can do it. And that to me is a really beautiful acknowledgement of like what fathers can do, what people who aren't mothers can do to raise children. And that's something that's been so important in my own life as a parent. But journalists didn't take that point up. Other researchers didn't take that point up. Harlow certainly did not take that point up in his raising of his own children. And so the image that really comes out of this research is of, you know, an adoring mother totally devoted to her child, even though that's not necessarily what those findings said it had to be.
And in fact, the findings were a lot more disturbing than that. I mean, these monkeys did not actually grow up to be fully realized monkeys.
Exactly.
But the other point is that these monkeys were supposed to say direct things about human beings. One of the points that you make in this book, Nancy Reddy, in The Good Mother Myth, Unlearning Our Bad Ideas About How to Be a Good Mom, is that the science, which was largely done, of course, by these men, was not very good science at all. What were some of the problems with the scientific approach?
Part of the problem, so there is always this problem with, you know, the leap from animals to humans. And of course, it makes a lot more sense in this case to do this research with animals than it does with human babies. But there's a long tradition of researchers, comparative psychologists and biologists in particular, being selective about what animals they look at, or looking at animals with an idea in mind of what they already expect to find. And so, you know, I mean, Harlow had started his primate research. He'd originally been a rat researcher, but he started his primate research at the zoo in Madison, which always seems funny to me because I spent a lot of time at the zoo with my kids when they were little. And he started out working with baboons and an orangutan. And if he had worked with them, he would have discovered very different things about, you know, animal motherhood, because it's not the case that even all primates raise their offspring in the same way. So when you leap from animal to human, obviously that's not the same. We're also not raising our children in cages, ideally. And we often have bad models for, or an incomplete understanding of, what kind of animal we're looking at and what that might mean about humans. But it turns out, of course, you know, it was great for Harlow's career to have people want to have him on TV and talk to women's magazines and give talks all over the place, because he really embraced the idea that he had discovered things that human women could take up as well. You know, you can make a space for yourself in the world if you tell mothers that you've figured things out for them. It's much less profitable and attention grabbing to say, well, you know, this is what we know about this species of monkey, and if we look at other monkeys, et cetera, et cetera.
I remember learning about that study, you know, years ago, and it always really pained my heart because I felt those wired monkeys with terry cloth covering couldn't possibly be providing the kind of relationship that the babies needed. And that, in fact, was key. What did happen to those monkeys? And in this, I think there is a parallel, not only to human children, but probably to any parent and child of any species.
Yeah, I mean, they initially looked great. You know, they grew, they gained weight, all of those kinds of things. You know, and Harlow said in this talk that he had made a perfect monkey mother, which always kind of makes me laugh because, of course, like, those monkeys had mothers that were actual monkeys that they had been separated from. But it turns out, as you say, that these children, these baby monkeys, were profoundly disturbed. I mean, they couldn't socialize. They couldn't, like, be housed with other monkeys. They would either fight or just kind of, like, pee in the corner. They couldn't mate. When they were artificially inseminated, many of those mothers were abusive to their own children, and they had been really deprived of a social context. You know, they were raised in what looked like kind of perfect conditions. You know, they had this mother who was there for them every second of the day, who was kind of doing, it sounds like, what your husband had suggested you should do, like, only feed the baby and gaze at the baby. And it turns out that that's not actually the way to raise a normal monkey at all. And, you know, I know I just said I'm wary of the leap from humans to animals, but I would argue that it's not really the way to raise a human baby either, that I think human babies actually need a lot more than the love of one mom.
So we talked about how so many of these theories were developed by men, and including Dr. Spock, who you talk about quite a bit. And I have to say, I did use Spock's book.
Yeah.
When I was a new mother, I don't remember very much about it, so I can't say that it made a huge impact on me. But the one person who took a very different approach to mothering was a woman, Margaret Mead. Tell us about her.
Margaret Mead was, like, the real research surprise of the book. She was someone who kept coming up kind of around the edges. Her daughter was actually, they call her daughter Dr. Spock's first baby. And she kept coming up in all of these conversations because she was, of course, a very active researcher at the same time as the, you know, kind of mostly male scientists that I'm writing about. And what I focused on with Mead was really how the research that she had done, the ethnographic work that she had done in Samoa while she was doing the research for her first book, Coming of Age in Samoa, how that research really shaped her approach to parenting. And of course, there's all kinds of, you know, she's a woman of her time. It's problematic in all these ways. She writes about being among the primitives. But I think she did really take seriously the idea that other cultures might have things to teach us. And what she saw there was that people were raising their children in communities, that there were lots of people involved in the raising of children. And she took that very seriously when she became a mother herself. I mean, she and her daughter and her husband, they eventually divorced, but they never had a house of their own. They always lived with other people and with other families. She called it a composite household. And I just think it's a pretty incredible model for not trying to create a kind of perfect nuclear family in a single family home, but of really intentionally cultivating a community around your child.
And she actually was interested in a far bigger question than the question of what, you know, what makes a good mother. She was interested in what makes a good community.
Mm-hmm. I think it just feels to me like this really, maybe now more than ever, kind of essential question. I think there's so much pressure for parents to try to focus on their own kids and kind of get their own kids every advantage and to optimize everything about their child's life, because the world is scary and people are afraid of their children not having the opportunities that they want them to have. But I think that there's a real model in Margaret Mead's work, and certainly in the work of a lot of Black feminists and Black sociologists, of what if instead of being obsessed about what my kid is getting, we thought about how can I make things better for every kid in this community? And I think that's a really important question for all of us to be asking now.
Yes. And when you think about it, you know, this whole right-wing movement that has not just been pushed by men, but by women as well, that is behind the anti-vaxxers, that supports the crazy ideas of Robert Kennedy Jr., that talks about women going back into the home. That whole vision presupposes that the community means nothing in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. That the nuclear family is the only thing that matters. And I think it's a really lonely way to live. I mean, I think we all, if we didn't know this, we all learned it for sure in those first weeks of the pandemic where, like, you know, I have a really great husband and two parents is not enough. You know, like, we all need more people in our kids' lives, and we all need more people in our own lives. And this vision of, as you say, women in the home, raising children, apparently raising a million children. I've been reading things about this, the pronatalist push by the White House and elsewhere. And it's just, I don't know. I kind of have no words for how wrong it is and how out of touch, I think. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't think it should be lost on anyone that this pronatalist movement is being led largely by men, you know, in the same way that the researchers that I look at in the book were saying, this is how to be a good mother. If you do it this way, it will be easy. It will be natural. Women are just perfectly suited to this work, but they weren't actually participating in the raising of their own children in any meaningful way. And I have a lot of questions about, you know, the men who were saying, oh, you know, you'll be so happy if you go home and have six children. That's what American women should be doing.
And of course, everywhere where this kind of pronatalist agenda has been pushed by governments, it's abysmally failed. When you think about Korea, Russia, because women aren't cooperating.
I mean, it turns out, like, if you actually want people to have at least the kids they want to have, right? A part of what scares me is the idea of persuading people that they should have kids, even if they don't want them, because that doesn't actually help anyone. But if you want to support people in having the children they want to have, like, we know what the answer to that is, right? You have good health care, you have paid parental leave, you have all those kinds of things. And that doesn't mean necessarily, like, a lot of those things have been tried, you know, are ongoing in various parts around the world, basically every developed nation other than ours. And they don't necessarily produce more births, but what they probably do produce is, like, happier families. And what they definitely produce is higher women's participation in the labor market, right? Women are more able to work, which I would say is an important measure of, like, the economic health of a country. And just personally, as someone for whom work is really meaningful, is probably a good measure of those women's overall health and happiness. But those are not necessarily the measures that, you know, the kind of pro-birth movement is interested in.
Right. And you make the point in the book, Nancy Reddy, in The Good Mother Myth, that the vision of the attachment theorists and Dr. Spock and all these other people was a vision that really excluded probably most women, certainly women of color, working class women who don't really have the choice to stay at home.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I say early on in the book that, you know, the good mother as such has kind of always been imagined as white and straight and married and middle class, and that our country has a long history of, you know, doing horrible things to exclude and actively punish people who do not fit those criteria, who end up becoming mothers or who choose not to become mothers. And so it's a really flawed ideal from the very beginning.
Let's talk a little bit about fathers. You mentioned your husband. You really took on the majority of parenting, and this really came to a head during the pandemic, in fact, when he worked from home. And at that time, of course, everybody was at home. It was a lockdown. You make the point that while there is an enormous industry of advice for women, there is very little advice that's available for fathers.
Yeah, it's a really interesting. I mean, I think about so many of the women that I know spend just enormous amounts of time and brain power, you know, consuming media and, you know, studying up as I did on how to do various things related to parenting. And, you know, I think that's not great. It's overwhelming. It's often unrealistic. Oftentimes I think like, man, you know, maybe just like go for a walk or like take a nap or something instead. Like that might actually be better for you than like reading another book about how to potty train your kid. But I think, you know, for men, I don't think there's that same kind of like mass media aimed at them, and our kind of cultural imagination of what it means to be a dad is pretty limited. It isn't nearly as rich. I think a lot of what actually does get aimed at men is pretty kind of condescending. You know, my husband and I joke a lot about like, oh, well, you know, what I don't even know how I would get the kids to school if you weren't here to do it. And like, he does do his share of the work. It's taken some deliberate work on both of our parts to learn how to share that work more equally. And I think you really have to fight, I think, the prevailing culture in order to get to anything like shared caregiving, especially when you have young kids.
The situation has improved, but not as much, not for real shared parenting in general. And I'd like to ask you, if you can say this, what has your husband learned? You know, how has it improved maybe your work and your discussions and his work? How has it improved his parenting, and how has it improved your kids' experience?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I'm always hesitant. I don't want to be careful to speak on behalf of my husband, but I can tell you what I observe, which is that like he's incredibly engaged, and he's also really tender in a way that I think is not often modeled for men. You know, I don't know that many men grow up in a house where they're like cuddling with their dad, and that is very much a part of our family culture. I think a lot of men don't, you know, the kind of generation of men who are raising children now, like didn't grow up in a culture that took their feelings seriously, that listened to them. And I feel really grateful that my husband is definitely modeling that for our kids. A lot of that, I think, is just who he is in a way that is really interesting to me. And some of it is also, you know, a mix of me asking him to do more in terms of practical stuff. Like, I need you to do the laundry, like just take over the laundry. I can't even think about it. It's too much for me. I need you to take over the laundry. I need you to take over lunches. And he's, you know, he does that. And some of it is also just like that because of my work and because of choices that I've made, I also just am gone. Not often, but I've been in a stretch of doing a lot of book promotion this spring, and I've been gone a lot. And so it means that, you know, the rest of my family has to learn how to function without me, which I think is really important for my kids to be able to see, like, oh, dad can actually handle all of this stuff. You know, it's not like the house falls apart when mom is in here. So I think that kind of forced sharing of the work has actually worked really well for us also.
And that emotional work is so important. I was really struck by an article I read the other day. I think it was in The Atlantic, which is about that boys may actually need even more sensitive parenting, more being listened to. That girls are more resilient naturally. Of course, this is just a generalization, than boys are emotionally.
Yeah.
And that our culture goes in the exact opposite direction. So it's not just about being a good mother, but more than that, really being a good parent and being sensitive to the individual needs of the child.
Yeah, I saw that article too. I think it's so, my friend Ruth Whitman wrote the book Boy Mom, and she's quoted in that article. And I was so struck by that finding when I read it in her book, that we so often have thought, you know, that boys are tough, that you can tell them to shake it off, et cetera. You know, those are the kind of cultural narratives that I think we're moving away from. And I don't know. I mean, I only have boys. I only have my two particular boys. So I'm hesitant to like say anything about boys or children in general, but they really both are so, so sweet and so thoughtful and so tender and sensitive as well. I don't know. I'm always very wary of ascribing anything to gender in particular, but I'm grateful to be raising them in a time when I think they're less likely to be surrounded by messages about what it means to be a boy that would cancel out those traits that I think are really beautiful and wonderful and special about them.
So your introductory chapter finally is titled Love is a Wondrous State, as if it's some kind of a magical thing. But at the end of the book, you have an alternative definition where you talk about what love really is. What do you say?
Oh, man. I mean, this is to me the thing that was really, you know, I started out writing this book. My kids were 3 and 5 and they were so little, and I had like kind of just barely started to come up from that really little kid phase. And I started out thinking it was really, I was writing a book about why motherhood was hard and trying to figure this out. And I think that is part of the project of the book, but I felt in the end, like I really was writing a book about love, which is, you know, why those chapter titles are the way they are and why the book is bookended in that way. And the Love is a Wondrous State comes from Harry Harlow and his Nature of Love talk. And then at the end, you know, one of the quotations that I think about a lot comes from a kind of French intellectual and historian, Elizabeth Badinter, and something that she said to her own children, which is that love is not a given, but a gift. And I just think it's such a beautiful, the idea that it's not automatic. You know, I think there is something, you know, I gave birth to my sons and I was like, oh, you like there is love there, at least for me, there was. But she really talks about love as being something that you build and something that happens over time. And that to me was a really important reframe, that it's not, as you say, a kind of magical state. It's a relationship. It's a thing that develops in time. And I think that's a really useful way of reframing love generally, but maybe especially parental or maternal love.
This is just such a terrific book, The Good Mother Myth, Unlearning Our Bad Ideas About How to Be a Good Mom. And it's just been terrific to talk with you about it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for these great questions.
Nancy Reddy teaches at Stockton University in New Jersey and leads community writing workshops and lifelong learning courses. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with beloved novelist Jennifer Haig about her new novel, Rabbit Moon. Also, L. Annette Binder returns to the show to talk about her profoundly moving memoir of her mother's descent into Alzheimer's disease. It's called Child of Earth and Starry Heaven. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.